Okay, this is Reverend Carl Tinsley. It is the 22nd of March, 2007. We are at his home on 2647 Spring Hill Drive, in the kitchen, and we're going to begin the interview now. Okay, introduce yourself.
I'm Reverend Carl T. Tinsley, 2647 Spring Hill Drive, Roanoke, Virginia. Place where I live 50 years almost, well, 40 some years.
Okay. And first we're going to start with some background questions. So, what's your date of birth?
Born 6/11/33. Times was hard then.
And where were you born?
I was actually born in Franklin County.
Okay.
In a place called Suntag, Virginia. A little mill community.
Suntag?
Suntag.
S-U-N-T-A-G. T-A-G.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you live there for your childhood?
Or? No, I was 6 months old. My father moved to West Virginia. And he was a coal miner, went to work in the coal mines. Mm-hmm. So we lived in West Virginia for 7 years. My mother was died when I was 7 years old. So we came back to me. My father came back to his parents' house. It was three in my family, my sister, my brother, myself. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother on my dad's side and grandfather took us in. And my father stayed in West Virginia and, you know, worked in the coal mine. So we left West Virginia where we had electric lights, wonderful schools, theaters, company stores, all you could ever ask for, you know, really modern. Mm-hmm. And then when we came to Virginia, we lived in a log cabin house with a kitchen built off, you know, to one side. And you couldn't hear nothing but the whippoorwills and the frogs and all that stuff, you know, in the evening. And didn't have electric lights neither. Everything was lamp, used lamps. And you couldn't tell whether it was a light on until you got in the rooms from the outside.
Okay. Now, indoor plumbing?
No. My Lord. Hey, we were more than that. We had outhouse with two seats. Oh. Two people would go at the same time.
So two bathrooms now.
Yes.
So did you, where was that in Virginia?
That was in Snow Creek. Now, when you leave Rocky Mountain going down 220 to turn off on 619, it goes all the way around and comes back into Monmouth. But some little communities, you know, down the road like Suntag, which is on the far side of Chestnut Creek, and if you cross on the creek, you enter what we call the Snow Creek section. So my father's people lived in Snow Creek. Mm-hmm. My mother's father and mother lived in Sunday.
Okay.
So I was born in a log cabin identical to Booker T. Washington's, only it had a wooden floor.
Oh, really? Now, are any of those log cabins still standing?
No, you know. That was on my mother's father's side. He was a blacksmith, I never forget. And the cabinet, when I was, I reckon 3 or 4 years old, we used to go to Virginia visit. Used to go down there and look at it. And Dad had told me they had to hang me up from the rafters when I was a baby to keep the rats and snakes from getting there.
Okay, so you lived there as a child. Which school did you go to?
We had an elementary school called Brown School.
Okay.
It was in the Snow Suntag area, and right off across Chestnut Creek. It was probably about a quarter of a mile, half a mile, up on the side of a hill. Mm-hmm. And we had a bus. One bus that used to run, come over all the way to right above our house. And turn around. Mm-hmm. And see, we lived out in the hollow, so we'd walk up the mountain to try to catch the bus. Sometimes we'd miss it. And we had to walk to school.
Mm-hmm.
You got 3 miles, you know. And you better not go back home, so.
Better just to keep on walking.
Keep on walking and walk to school. And a lot of times in the evening, we'd have to wait for the bus coming down from Rocky Mount, because it dropped off children that was going to high school, Franklin County Training School. They would be dropped off, then they'd pick us up. Well, a lot of times we get out of school, we just walk home.
Mm-hmm.
And especially pretty weather, you know, rather than wait on the bus. It was quite a life. Brown School, we had one teacher. When I was going, Miss Chappie Good, bless her heart. She taught from first to seventh grade. And she had, you know, taught all of us, and I wonder sometimes how she did that. But when I left West Virginia, I was in the second grade, I think. Second grade, I believe. And I just couldn't get math. Math was just a block. And she was a pretty large person, but she squares in beside my seat and says, "Hun, let me show you how to do this." And you know, from that day on, I went to the head of the class when it comes to math, doing math. Mm-hmm. It was like somebody opened a window for me.
But so now, she helped you?
Yeah, she helped me, and I always gave her credit for that. She was a wonderful person. Taught all her life, a dedicated teacher. And one that we should hold in high esteem, because she did so much for the community.
Now, and you said that was to seventh grade that you had her?
Yeah, she taught to the seventh grade, yeah. But now, see, we left. I think I was in the fourth grade, maybe 2 years, sixth grade, when my father decided to housekeep again, so he came and got us and we went back to West Virginia.
And where in West Virginia?
Other side of Beckley, a place called Wine and Guff.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a coal camp. And my father had a house and we lived there until 1947, I believe. Might have been 46 or 47. Mm-hmm. And we moved back to Virginia, back to with my grandparents. And I went to high school in Franklin County. At that time, Franklin County only had 11 grades. And I was, going from one school to the other, I'd got one or two grades behind. So I was smart, but being poor, not having much, when I was with my grandfather, we had to work. We had to work on the farm. My brother and I, if we never cut another stick of wood or hoe another stalk of corn or tobacco, we done our share as youngsters. And I was 13 years old when I got my first job. I worked for a sawmill guy, and he was very good to me, to all the young black kids in that area. My cousin, myself, we went to work for him. Now, we'd walk 3 miles, 4 miles, you know, to work. Work all day and come on back, walk back that evening, or sometimes catch a ride on a truck. But it was just one of those things. I was, at 12 years old, I was 6'2". I was so skinny. I wasn't nothing but arms and legs. But I was strong. I was working on the farm and cutting, you know, trees and doing all that work. I was strong little fella. And when I turned, let me see, I think I was in school when I turned 16. I turned 16. I came to Roanoke. And was with my step uncles. At that time, my father had married again. And my step uncles, we were like brothers. Because it wasn't too much different between our age. So two of them was brick masons. They used to work during the winter laying brick within the summer. But when the weather was bad, they worked at Lewisville Hospital. So they knew people, weren't they? I came over at 16, got a job. Used to wax, polish those brass doors on Luck Avenue. And on 2nd Street, actually. And the post office was right across the street, the real one. So I'd pick up mail for the hospital. And what happened, I had planned to go back to school. But, you know, when you start working, making a little money... And I thought, well, I can catch up. I'll wait a month or two. And, you know, kind of just kept putting things off. And in 1949, And then in 1950, I was still working there. And the Korean War broke out. Well, my step-uncle joined the Navy. And because they would have drafted him anyhow. So I wanted to go when I was 16. But they had a recruiting station at the post office. So the guys used to say, "Hey, won't you, by me being 6'2", come on, why don't you join the Navy?" And I said, I don't know, I'm too young, I think. He said, oh, I said, I'm just 16. He said, when will you be 17? I said, June. He said, I'll tell you what, if you pass the test, we'll sign you up. And when you turn 17, if you get permission from your father, you know, you can go to training. Mm-hmm. So I did. I took the test, and I passed it. And he said, my God, some of the college kids didn't pass this test. You passed it. So anyhow, we set a date for August. That's when I would, after I turned 17 in June, and I would leave in August. Mm-hmm. And that's how it happened. I left Roanoke on a train going to Richmond, where I was sworn in. 9 white guys and 1 black, that was me. Mm-hmm. This was still doing segregation time. Trains were still segregated. Mm-hmm. But when we were sworn in, the guy gave the papers to one of the other guys and says, wherever he go, you all go. He got your meal tickets and everything, you know. So I'm on the train, our Lord. I was so afraid, waiting for the man to come and say, you can't eat here, you know, you can't eat. Mm-hmm. But they allowed us to sit together and eat. And when I got to Chicago, I went to Great Lakes, Illinois. When I got to Chicago, I was still thinking we were in the South. And then it dawned on me, hey, I'm in the North now.
Was it a little different?
Yeah, it really was. I'd never seen such wide streets in my life. Mm. You know, being a country boy, never been to a big city other than Roanoke and Beckley. Man, oh man, that was a thrill. But in Great Lakes, Illinois, there was 3 blacks in my outfit. Out of 265 men, there's only 3 blacks. And the fact they hadn't been long integrated to Navy, where, you know, we could train with everybody else and do what we wanted to, strike for what we wanted to. So I had a 16-week training. Mm-hmm. 16 weeks, yeah. During that time, my grandmother died, and my dad and them didn't tell me because they didn't want to break my training. Mm-hmm. And I was so sorry when I found out. Cried like a baby all night. I had to cover my head up so those guys in the barracks couldn't see me crying. Yeah, but I made it through training. One of the black guys didn't make it. He just didn't have the stamina to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
And another guy from New York named Tuttle, he and I. And after training, we went to Points Point, Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. Navy Air Station. During that time, you could pick whatever field you want. So I picked aviation. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be a pilot. And I was attached to Anti-Submarine Squadron 31. Mm-hmm. And we had about 22 planes, single-engine planes. And all we had to do was patrol the Atlantic coast to keep submarines out, this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. We had sophisticated gear that we'd use, sonar and receivers we'd drop in the water. And if we thought of pick up a sub, we had those planes with radar. You could pick up a target 500 miles away. This big plane, the one with the big belly on it, you see? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They call it the mother hen. And then once they picked up a signal, they would vector us. In other words, they'd send us to check it out. Mm-hmm. So we were lighter and we could fly fast. And of course, submarines have radar too. Mm-hmm. And about 50 miles, maybe they can pick us up. So they'll dive. And we'll plot the time for the time it takes us to get to the place they dive, and we start dropping sonar balls in the water, the whole circle. Mm-hmm. And that's amazing. You can hear the screws turning on the submarine. Shoo, shoo. And you can even hear people talking.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So that's
kind of
like a cat and mouse game.
Yeah, well, see, they have silent. Once they know we're on, they're silent. But somebody happened to drop a wrench or something else, cling, cling, you could hear it.
Really?
And we never ran into enemy subs. We had our own subs, you know, training. And for 4 years, I was in this outfit. 3 years straight, we went to Cuba. It's been three months in Cuba. And we operated off the carrier and the base. The base was our home base, Corsair Point. Mm-hmm. But I served on about 5 different aircraft carriers.
Now, when you say the base, was that Guantanamo?
Corsair Point, Rhode Island.
Okay.
Corsair, Q-U-N. I forgot how to spell it. But it was a naval air station.
Okay.
And they had a lot of planes. That's when I found out, you know, I didn't think that, I thought the Air Force had all the planes, but Navy has as many planes or more as the Air Force.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
So how long were you in the service?
Almost 4 years. I went in 50 and I came out in 54. I got out a few months early because my outfit was going on a Mediterranean cruise, and my time would have been up in the middle of that cruise, so they let me out early.
Now, you had said something earlier about segregation, and it wasn't segregated when you went in. Did you ever encounter any hostility or any negativity while in the Army? I mean, Navy?
Really not, not that much so in the Navy. You know, we all went through training together, and you had some guys in there who was real racist, but they didn't bother me or others because I was the only one in my outfit. It was one other black, but I was the only one. So we were good friends, especially all the white guys from the South.
Mm-hmm.
We stuck together. They used to follow me around, I tell you.
Now, how about in the community at large?
Now, the community at large, Rhode Island, Rhode Island is a small state.
Mm-hmm.
And in town now, some of the places you might go, you didn't really find that much because they wanted the money. But Boston, Boston was one of the worst racist states that ever walked on the face.
Really?
Yes, Lord.
Okay.
There was communities in Boston you didn't dare be caught in. Really? You wouldn't make it out. People disappear up there.
Ooh.
As a matter of fact, years later, after I'd been out of service and worked with the NAACP, we had a state convention up there, national.
Mm-hmm.
And the mayor got up and said, "You're all welcome. You can go anywhere you want to, you know." And the people up there got up and told them, "No, you can't. Mm. It is still just as racist now as it was back in the 30s and 20s.
Really?
Because you got the Italians, you got different nationalities living there.
Mm-hmm.
And those people are very, very, very prejudiced.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I found that out the hard way.
Did you go into the wrong neighborhood at one time?
No, most time being a cell when you went to town, you went to where the bars was, where the girls was.
Mm-hmm.
But it was quite an experience to see people. And sometimes, even in Rhode Island, Providence, that's where we were, Providence. You go in there and you go to a small place and you can tell people didn't want to wait on you.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have signs on the door saying no color here, no black here, no. But they showed it. I told my father when I came home on my first leave, I said, "Daddy, the people in the South will rise up and we'll live together and we'll be able to live at, in harmony among ourselves." But it would never happen in the North.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Maryland was one of the most segregated states I ever came through.
Really?
And of course, it's not that way that much now, but during the time when I was in service, it was.
Mm-hmm. Now, how about Roanoke? Sorry, I'm not giving you a chance to drink your coffee.
Yeah, Roanoke, when I came to Roanoke, like I said, from the country, my first time coming to, a city in its size.
Mm-hmm.
And being with people that you know and look up, you knew it would help you make it. Because one of the guys worked at the hospital, he and I roomed at the same house,
mm-hmm.
Pete. And we eat at the hospital, so we'd go across Henry Street, me and my friend, my guy my age named Quentin, and we'd shoot pools, do different things, mm-hmm. Go to the drugstore and buy coke. On Brooks' store, and I didn't go to, at that time I was a little young, I didn't go to all of
the other
clubs and but I did that after I came out of service. Before I went to service, now I felt good when I used to leave downtown. Once I got across Henry Street Bridge,
mm-hmm.
I was home. I wasn't worried about anybody doing anything to me. People saying things to you or doing anything to you. I was in my own community. Mm-hmm. Where we had our restaurants and stores and pool halls and shoeshine shops, you know, everything. Mm-hmm. And restaurants, so it was always, it was a relief when I got across that bridge.
Because
downtown, I could go into Crescent's and Woolworth's and buy, you know, a hot dog, and I had to go outside to eat it. Mm. They wouldn't let you stay outside in little cafes they had on the streets. You could go in and they'd sell you something, but you had to go outside. Mm-hmm. You couldn't eat inside or sit down. And when I left Roanoke, it was still that way. When I got back, I went back after service. I went to Rocky Mount. Mm-hmm. And I lived with my father and my stepmother for about a year and a half. I worked at Bassett. Mm-hmm. Got me a job, went to work at making furniture. Mm-hmm. Hardest job in town. the first job I had. Now, this is the way it was, believe me. Mm-hmm. On Monday morning, every morning at the factory, it would be me and them waiting to be hired. You need a job, you just go and wait. Mm-hmm. If somebody didn't show up, they'd hire you and put you in their place. Now, you couldn't miss a day. You couldn't miss a day. Mm. Without your supervisor really, you know, working with you on that. Mm-hmm. So when I went there on a Monday, and the guy looked at me and he looked at my long arms and says, "I got a job." I said, "What is it?" He said, "Rub and filler." I said, "No, I don't think I want that." Because everybody had warned me, "Don't take the filler rubber job. That's the hardest job in the factory. Don't let them get you that job." So I had to go back home, and it didn't get hired. So I came back Tuesday. Same guy was down there saying, "Got the same job." So I looked at him, I said, "Anybody else doing that job?" He said, "Yeah, Green Minister, he's been doing it 16 years. I said, "Well, if he can do it, I can do it." So I went on to work. Mm-hmm. And what it did, rubbing filler, down in the furniture factory, when you first start out in the lower end, it's just rough lumber. Mm-hmm. And they cut it and put it together. By the time I get upstairs where I worked, it's a piece of furniture. Mm-hmm. And the guys are spraying filler on it, you know, to fill the cracks. And it dries, and then you have to rub it, mm-hmm, to give it a smooth surface so you can put a varnish on it. And that's, you know, everything moves on a chain. Mm-hmm. In the morning, the guy puts the button and starts from the low end downstairs by the block down. And when they get up to where I am, it's, you know, moving. Mm-hmm. And the only break we got is when the chain broke or something happened. It stopped. And it would be so dusty in there, all you could see was just a round light, that filler dust. Mm-hmm. And I thought about this just like working in a coal mine. But anyhow, I was doing it all day long. The next day, I got up to go to work. I was trying to, Daddy fix breakfast for us. Because he worked at another place, and I got my coffee, and I had to do this. I couldn't even raise my arm. I told Dad, I said, "I'm about to quit. I can't even get my arms up today." But you know, the funny thing, psychological, when they punched that button, that chain started, you know, we had to take this cloth and start, four of us worked on that line. And boy, I tell you, at the end of a year, I looked at form. My arms through here were so big. You know how Popeye's arms used to look? Uh-huh. That's how my arms looked. I had a small body, red, red, red big arms.
So you managed to stay there a year and a half?
Yeah, I worked there. Well, I quit there and I went to American Furniture Factory in Martin. I worked over there for a while. Mm-hmm. And I came back and I worked at the veneering plant. That's where I was working when I got married. Now, but the veneer is where they shave logs, you know, different logs, mm-hmm, to put over poplar or pine. You think you're getting oak, but you're getting really a veneer, real thin slice. And I worked in that veneering plant for, right at a year. In fact, that's the only place they held my job for 6 weeks.
Really?
I told the guys, "I'm getting married this weekend, I'll be back next week."
They're still waiting on you, huh?
Yeah, the guy I work with, Tommy Webb, told me, said, "Tinsley, you're the only man I know, the man held a job, wouldn't hire nobody for 6 weeks, hoping you'd come back." And after we got married, right on River Boulevard, 1308 River Boulevard, my sister-in-law's house. Mm-hmm. We had a weekend honeymoon. The only hotel that was available for blacks was Pine Oaks Inn up in Salem. Mm-hmm. And it had 6 rooms, 1 bathroom. So we spent the night there, Saturday night, and Sunday we came back and went up to her mother's house. Her mother and father, her father was a coal miner too, but he quit mining for a while and he was living here. Mm-hmm. And they lived up in, off of Wildwood Road, had a big house up there. So we lived with them for maybe 3 months. Mm-hmm. And I got a job working at Shoney's Big Boy. Mm-hmm. On Lee Highway. I was hired as a porter, a janitor, a porter, whatever you want to call it, and paid me $22 a week, 6 days a week and 9 hours a day. Wow, that's right. And then I worked part-time at a hospital, Rothmore Hospital, mm-hmm. when they only had the one building. And then I got a job at the city. As a cleaner, a janitor, mm-hmm. and I worked there almost a year. In 1957, I got a job on the extra board at N&W. Mm-hmm. So I quit the city, and I was working and making twice the money when I went to work for the railroad. Really? Oh, that was good. Lord, we were in heaven then. Cost of living was cheap, you know, and everything. Uh-huh. And I was making twice the money at the railroad than I was making at the city. Mm-hmm. My salary city was $235 a month, mm-hmm. at that time. And my first check at the railroad, I was making over $400-some.
Wow.
Oh, wow. Right. And everything was going wonderful for 3 months. And then we got cut off.
Oh.
Laid off. Mm-hmm. They merged with the Virginia Railway. And, you got to eliminate some jobs. So last hired. In fact, I was working as an extra man in him, but I got kicked in the street. So I went back to Shoney's, mm-hmm. worked for Shoney's Big Boy, and worked out in the community, did floors, washed floors, and did wonders for people. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I could make a dollar. And I got called back to Norfolk Southern. I was still on the extra board. So you might work one day a week, or maybe work one day a half, you know. Mm-hmm. Depending if anybody didn't lay off, you didn't get to work. Mm-hmm. So I went to work for Bluefield Hardware. Because I was working off Southern at night whenever they needed me. Mm-hmm. And it used to be right beside H&C Coffee downtown. Mm-hmm. And I drove the truck, delivered furniture and appliances all over. Drove to West Virginia to Bluefield Hardware out there, bringing stuff back and taking it out. And I'd work when I could at night at railroad. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until around about 59, I really began to get ready to work. Mm-hmm. And I quit Bluefields because it was too much of me, really. Mm-hmm. And I finally got a regular job at the railroad. So I went in the mail. I worked as a janitor, and then I went in the mail room. The mail room was the only job, decent job there for blacks at the time. Mm-hmm. You could wear a tie and a shirt. And we handled all the incoming mail and all the outgoing mail, mm-hmm. which was company mail and U.S. mail. So I worked as extra. Somebody was off for that work, and finally two of the guys retired, so I got a job there. And I finally wound up running the mail room, and liked it because I was selling real estate on the side. I'd got my license with Hale Real Estate Agency, and I was selling real estate on the side. And the reason I did that because I was trying to buy a house and I couldn't. Mm-hmm. Banks wouldn't leave you no money, and you just couldn't get, you know. And even though I was making pretty good money, my wife was working, they said they couldn't depend on her. She was childbearing age, so they wouldn't consider her salary at all. And that went on for a while. And one day, now when in the mail room, it was a very big room, had boxes all around where we had put the mail up for everybody, mm-hmm. for every department. And so I liked it because once I got my work caught up, I'd go out and show a house, you know, and come on back when a train come in to be there to get the other mail. Mm-hmm. I made sure it was, my work was done. Well, one of the messengers one day come down. They would hire a kid maybe out of high school to be a messenger. And come to find out, he was making $200 more than a month than I was, and I'm running the mail room. So I met Mr. Dunlap. He was the vice president at that time. I met him out in the hall because he come out and pick the mail up all the time. And I said, Mr. Dunlap, it's a shame that the messengers make more money than we do in the mail room, when our responsibility is so much greater. So he said, well, I'm going to tell Turner to go over and get you fellows a raise. Turner was the billing manager. So he went over and talked to the personnel and come back and met me in the hall. Now, this is before I started preaching, okay? And he says, I got you boys a raise. I said, how much? 3 cents on the hour. So I told him where to stick it. I was angry. I really was. I was angry.
I would imagine.
And I told him where to put it. And I kept on walking. I went upstairs to the freight traffic department. They had a job on the board, a file clerk. So Mr. Maynard, he was an administrator. And I told him, I said, I want that job. I got seniority and I can get it. I don't know if Mr. Turner going to let you go. I said, if you don't, I'm going to be the richest black man in town. That I'm going to sue this company. So anyhow, I got the job and started making $200 more in a month. And I moved around. I moved from file clerk to rate clerk. And I had to qualify. You had 90 days to qualify on all these jobs. Now, filing is just simple. Anybody can do that. But working rates and doing rates is a tremendous job, because you had to go through books. Back in the year 1942, and break the rate and bring it all the way up and put increases on it. And I worked Transcon, which was the West Coast line. And nobody would help me except one white guy named Bobby West. He worked with me and helped me a lot. The guy that was the chief clerk, and he tried his best to get me disqualified. But I made it. Then I went from there to the Tariff Bureau, to Piggyback. We called it Piggyback Intermodal. And I worked in Intermodal for about 5-6 years, back to freight traffic. And I worked as a chief clerk until the merger with Southern, and then they moved out. They moved all our titles back, and we didn't, you know, try to put everything together so everybody would just came a clerk. And before, they had different positions you could bid on, you know, chief clerk, assistant chief clerk, and different things. Then they made all of them just clerks. So I worked there often. Well, I worked in Northwestern for the time off and on. It's 38 years. 1971, I was called in the ministry. I was working Piggyback at that time. As a matter of fact, they did a story on me in the old NW magazine. And I have it right here somewhere, but I don't know where. And the title was The Best of Two Worlds, because I was able to pass a small church in Catawba and also work. They couldn't afford it. They really couldn't afford a pastor, you know. So I thought my pastor made me feel like I was on top of the world. When they called me to that church, he says, Brother Tinsley says, if I'd have had a church like this when I first went to ministry, I'd have been sitting on the world. I got up there. The people couldn't sing, witnessing. I had to do all the singing until I got... I really did. But I finally got to church and, you know, moved up and baptized my first people. In fact, I just funeralized one of the girls yesterday. Not yesterday, day before yesterday. Who that I found, one of the young ladies I first baptized. She's 54 years old when she died. But I stayed in prayer for often, really 7 years, but I had other churches too. One time I was pastoring 3 churches and working.
Wow.
And what happened, I'd have one on the first, two on the first Sunday, and one on the second Sunday. And then when I went to a full-time church, I had a full-time church in Natural Bridge, Virginia. I pass at Indian Rock, 2 o'clock, and then I go 7 o'clock to Catawba.
So you did a lot of driving.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, yes. But it was a joy for me to do that. And then I didn't stay at Natural Bridge but one year. Mm-hmm. And I got called to First Baptist Church in Pecova there, mm-hmm. where I pastored there about right at 15 years. I took a sabbatical and had brain surgery and went to Buena Vista to help them out, and they called me to be the pastor. Mm-hmm. So I've been there going on, would be 15 years this actually in July.
Okay. When you said you had the brain surgery, what was?
I had a pituitary gland tumor.
Okay.
I was blind in my left eye. And the tumor had killed killed the main gland that gives your body what it needs.
Mm-hmm.
So when they found out, and you know, they gave me medicine to supplement what my gland wasn't doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I still had to have a surgery because I was blind.
Mm-hmm.
So they went up through my nose, my mouth, in the middle of my head and took the tumor out.
Really?
The first operation was in 92.
Mm-hmm.
I had to have it again in 99. So since then, I've been doing pretty good.
Since then? And did you get your sight back?
Oh, yeah. My sight came back after the first operation.
Oh.
What happened, the doctor said the tumor was like a clothesline.
Mm-hmm.
The optic nerve, rather. The tumor had propped up the optic nerve. And like you prop up a clothesline. So once it removed the tumor and let it down, but it was a swag in there, so he took some fat out of my side,
mm-hmm.
and put in that hole that the tumor came out of.
Wow.
And when I woke up, he, can you see? Yeah, Doc, I can see. That was a great thing, really.
To get the sight.
Yes, back. Lord have mercy, yeah. And you know, the fact that being blind, I didn't know I was blind.
Oh.
I knew something was wrong because for the past 3 or 4 months, I didn't have no energy. My joints was aching.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like a 90-year-old man. And I told my wife, I said, I don't know how a 90-year-old man is supposed to feel, but that's what I feel like. We laughed about that. But, and when I found out that, you know, I had a tumor, I went to work one day, and normally I take my glasses off to work. I just set them on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to read some small tariff, and I couldn't read, and I took the glasses, I put them on. Didn't help it, taking them off. And I said, my eyes are changing. I need to call my eye doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So I called him and told him I need to see him that week. So he said, all right, Carl, come on in on Wednesday. Okay, Doc. So I go see him, and you know, and come up to say, I read the chart. Okay, Doc. Fill with that eye. Nothing was blind, black spot.
Couldn't see.
I said, Doc, I'm blind. In my left eye. Well, Dr. Shortridge and I was pretty good friends. He said, Carl, this can't happen that quick. What happened? So he said, hey, did you see anybody? Have you seen anybody since you seen me? I said, yeah. I broke my glasses, you know, when I was downtown. I went and got an optometrist, and he fixed the glasses, and he also checked my eye. So he called him, and he ran every test he could think of. Finally, he called a neurosurgeon, made an appointment with me to see him that day. And when I went to see him, he ran some tests and told me I had to have an MRI to be sure what was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I just knew I had a brain tumor. I'm just, oh God.
You had the feeling?
That night, I didn't sleep a wink.
Well, but 99 was your last surgery?
99 at UVA. The first surgery was here at Roanoke.
Mm-hmm.
It was a miracle. When I went to see the neurosurgeon, he told me, he said, Reverend Tinsley, I'll tell you what. He's this man here named Duncan.
Mm-hmm.
He's done, I think he's done 8 operations like yours, 8 or 9.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the best I've ever seen. And so I want you to go see him. So I did. I remember my wife went to see him. He talked with us. He told us what all he's going to do. And he did it. Now, he done something starting that Friday. I had to have surgery that Monday.
Mm-hmm.
So he put me on steroids.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I'm going to give you steroids every 4 hours. I was taking. And he said, that's to make the membrane in your head tough. So when I press down, it won't tear. It'll just be like jello.
Mm-hmm.
It'll press down and it'll come back, you know. And it was unusable. But that's when I found out why people use steroids. Now, you're talking about making you feel good and giving you energy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Lord have mercy.
Gave you energy?
Yeah, after I served, you know, I'm laying in bed the day after. Everybody said, you had surgery? Yeah. All I had was a little drip patch across my nose. And I came home after 5 days. I looked out there in the yard, spring of the year, about this time. And grass began to grow, and I wanted to get out there and rake the yard so bad.
Five days after surgery.
Yeah, but what he did, the day after surgery, he began to take me off the steroids.
Mm-hmm.
Gradually. My legs ached me like a toothache. I couldn't understand why my legs were hurting so bad until much later, you know, that it was a withdrawal. So I know what people go through when they have these withdrawals. Some, you know, the whole body hurting, they go through different things.
Mm-hmm.
But my legs.
That's what bothered you?
Oh, God, they ache like a toothache. But after I got through that, you know, and I was home, I felt like, oh, I could have run a mile. Stuff got out of my system.
Different story.
Yeah, I was back to normal.
Well, and let me back up, too. You had mentioned that the year that you got married to your wife, how did you meet her? And I guess, where did she live?
Well, my wife was born in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
But she lived in, her father was a coal miner like my dad.
Mm-hmm.
But she had an aunt that had a lot of land in Franklin County. Her aunt gave her mother a farm over in Franklin County,
mm-hmm.
About 3 or 4 miles from where we live.
Okay.
So her brother, she had 5 brothers and 4 sisters. Two of the older sisters was married. That's where we got married, the older sister's house.
Mm-hmm.
But when we used to go across the mountain as kids to play with her brother and sister.
Mm-hmm.
And besides, she was going to Brown School.
Okay.
And when she started her first year, she was a little unique. Now, she didn't walk with, we'd all be walking, playing, you know, she'd be ahead of everybody. Swing a slew-foot, swing-net lunch bucket. And my brother used to pick at her, and she'd take that button and beat him up. I tell you, she was mean little thing. And when we go across the mountain to play with them, they'd peep around the house to see us and take off. So anyhow, I had thought nothing more about that. We went back to West Virginia,
mm-hmm.
and they went back to West Virginia finally.
Mm-hmm.
And they stayed out there. She went to school at Conley High School, which was an integrated school, mm-hmm. right out of Mullins. Called place called Garwood.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she graduated and she came to live with a sister in Roanoke,
mm-hmm.
older sister on Rubber Boulevard. So I met a brother one day downtown. I said, where's Yvonne? But let me regress. I didn't see her no more until I was 18.
Mm-hmm.
18. Her grandfather died. So they were over in down from West Virginia. It said she was still in school,
mm-hmm.
to for his funeral. I was home on leave,
mm-hmm.
so me and my stepbrothers, we were all about the same age. We went up to see him, and her sister and I were in the same grade when I was going to school.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, "Well, I'm going to see Dolores," but I wound up sitting on the couch beside her,
mm-hmm.
and she had bloomed and blossomed then. I tell you. So we got in the car and rode over town, you know, like young people do, and we started talking. So I took her address, she took mine. We started writing to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Off and on for about 3.5 years. And I didn't see her but that one time.
Mm.
And she sent me a picture, I sent her a picture. And I wouldn't show the guys her picture when I was in service because I thought they'd accuse me of robbing the cradle. She looked so young. But I kept a picture, and when I got out of service, I kind of just broke away from that part, you know, working at Bassett,
mm-hmm.
and living at home. And when I met Lawrence, he told me, well, she's over here in Roanoke, over on River Boulevard. Man, I tore off. I went up and asked out for a date, so I used to take her to dances and whatnot, but I was going to take her to the movie one day, And I got to the movie, parked on Old Virginia Theater. And I needed a nickel for the parking meter. I didn't have no change. I said, honey, Yvonne, you got a nickel? I'm not giving you no money. And I said, well, I don't have no change. Well, I'm not going to give you anything. I said, well, we going back home. I took her back home.
Oh, you did?
I don't think nobody could have that but me. So, but we dated. I'd come over. I had made up my mind. I was tired of just running around on Saturday, you know, doing this. I wanted to settle down. I wanted a family. Really, I wanted a family, and I wanted to settle down. So I started coming to see her regular. I was working at Bassett, and I'd leave Bassett, come home, dress, and ride her on the... Well, my daddy was... He used to stay down there sometimes. He'd be sitting over one chair asleep, and I'd be sitting in another.
Now, how much younger was she than you? Or, well, was she younger or older?
Yeah, she was younger. She was 2.5 years younger.
2.5, okay.
We got married in 56. And first son was born in 57.
Okay. And how many children do you have?
Well, I told you we had did I tell you?
I think you might have written it, but we didn't talk.
Okay, my brother, Eugene Tinsley. He was, his wife, the girl he was living with, they had 3 children. Mm-hmm. She just had one. In fact, Faye had just had, you know, he was born about a week before I got married. And I picked him up at the hospital. I picked her and him up, carried him home. And three weeks later, she died. Mm. And so Yvonne and I took the baby. Mm-hmm. We had our 1 month honeymoon. And we took the baby that Monday, and we kept him for close to 2 years. He was right 19 months old, I think. Mm-hmm. My brother had moved to D.C. He called my father about a month before his death and says, Daddy, if anything happened to me, would you take my children and raise them? Mm-hmm. And Dad promised him he would. So when my brother, he was killed in Washington on Fort Benning Road, he and a friend, really actually his friend, they got to fighting. And my brother always fought with fists, but this guy was a knife man. He stabbed him. Mm-hmm. And he died. He died really because they didn't treat him. They could have saved his life at the hospital, but back then they wouldn't do operating unless they got permission, you know. Mm-hmm. By the time they contacted Dad, it was 4 or 5 hours later. He bled internally. Mm-hmm. And he had told the police that it was an accident, so they didn't charge the guy. Mm. But we had a baby then. Terry was born, so we decided, since Daddy didn't let us be separated, you know, we'd try to get all the kids together. Mm-hmm. It was 2 boys and 1 girl. Well, her mother came and got the girl and went back to Buffalo, New York. And we tried, you know, to get her, but decided it wasn't worth it. Just too much trouble to go through to try to get her. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, we took Dino over to be with his brother. That's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. We had to leave him. Mm-hmm. Oh, Lord. If I had to do over, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. But I really worked out best because he and his brother grew up together. Mm-hmm. And I used to call her Faye's mother and tell her let Edith come down so she could meet her brothers and they could spend some time together. Mm-hmm. So she used to come down during the summer sometime when she got a certain age, and she stayed with us and I'd take her over and they would get with her brothers. Mm-hmm. So they had a relationship and a fellowship. And right now, the oldest son, my oldest nephew, he's dead. And Dino, the one we kept, he lives here in Roanoke and works for the VA.
Okay.
And Edith, she's in New York, bless her heart. Debating whether she want to come up and live down this part again. Because her grandmother who had raised her, she's dead. And she don't have, she got one son, two, a son and a daughter and a granddaughter. So she was talking about moving back here. I told her she needs to come back and be close to her brother.
Yeah.
And I hope she'll do that.
Now, so did you have one child or did you have...
Two sons. Michael was born in 58. And we almost lost him pneumonia twice. But when he was 18, 17 really, he wanted to quit school. You know how these youngsters go through this stage. So he and his kids were going to work together. They want to live in an apartment. I said, okay, maybe you can make it. You don't. Everybody don't need education. Maybe you can make it. So anyhow, he and his two or three friends, they had a house over here on Norfolk Avenue. Had a cold stove in there. And they worked at the Lewis Community Hospital. So all of them got laid off with him. He was carrying the load. And he said it was ratcheting us so big they'd pick up one with the stove plate. But I told him, I said, I'll tell you what, you got to give up your house key. Now, he didn't want to do that. I said, you can't live at two places, my house. I told him we was trying to teach him a lesson, which we did. So after about 3 or 4 months, he called me, Daddy, can I come home and visit? I said, yeah. Someone picked him up. So he was in the car and riding. He said, Dad, I'm coming back home. I said, I don't think so. I drove on. I said, if I remember correctly, you asked me if you could leave. So you'll have to ask me if you can come back. He slumped down in the seat. Dad, can I come home? I said, yeah. My rules stand. Your mama's rules stand. You get your butt back in school, and you do what you're supposed to do. So he came back, and it was right after that he wanted to join the Army. So his mama says, she came in one day, he was laying in the bed asleep, she went out to work, she says, when I get back here, you better have a job, or you better be laying in my bed. So he went and joined the Army, and went taking his training in New Jersey. And then he went to Fort Benning, Georgia. And we had really gotten close during that time. And we would write, call each other. I called him all the time. And I got a call once Monday from I didn't get no call. My next door neighbor. She was home, and I was at work. Your mom was at work, and Terry was married. He was in the Marine before Count June. So anyhow, she says, Reverend Tennessee, some servicemen over here to see you. I said, oh God, tell them I'll be there in a few minutes. They said, no, you stay where you are. They're coming to where you are. So I knew something was wrong. But I thought it was my oldest son. And the reason I thought it was him, that particular Sunday, I had preached out in Montville on homecoming. I preached on the family. When I got home, Terry had left me a note. We called him Terry because your mom said she couldn't have two calls. And he left me a note. He said, Daddy, I took the battery out of the other car because my battery was bad. And I told you one, I said, oh, God, that battery's bad, too. And I was worried about him because it was a terrible storm coming up. And they had to go through that storm. So all night long, I was worried. And waiting the next day so a certain time so I could call and find out if he made it okay. But when she told me those service members, I just said, oh, God, I hope he didn't have a wreck. And, you know, because Sheila was pregnant with our first grandchild. And I was just toe up. But when it said, no, they're from the Army. And I knew something happened to with Mike. And so they told me that MP had killed him that night, Sunday night. And I said, well, what happened? They said, we don't know. We just don't know. So I called his commander. I got on the phone, I called him. I said, I want to know what happened. He said, well, Reverend Tennessee, the MP, they broke the door down to his barracks and shot him. I said, why? He says, I don't know. He said, but we're investigating it now. So I got on, I came home, went and got Yvonne, had to tell her that her son was dead. That was the hardest thing I ever done in my life. How do you tell a mother that a baby's dead? And so I went, she was working at ITT at that time. I went out and got her. And I went by and got a sister first because I told her, I said, I can't handle it by myself. Mm-hmm. Her and her sister, Jalo, I said, grew up like, they were just like twins almost. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, we got her and I came on home. And I got on the phone, I started making some phone calls. So I told the man, I said, I don't want y'all to do nothing to him till he get here. They said, we've got the embalming. But I said, I want to know what happened. So the guy said, well, he had barricaded himself in his room, and he wouldn't open the door, and the duty officer didn't get him over the door, so he called for the MP. Well, the MP came, and it was two, what they call MID men, that's special service men, they're big guys. Mm-hmm. He was angry when he got there. He jumps out of his Jeep, because he couldn't find a place for a long time. He run up there, said, where's he at? They said, in the room. He didn't talk to the duty officer, he didn't ask nobody, no question. Break the door down. The clipping from when the door knocked on son and he got up, he said, freeze you, MS, I blow you away. Bam! All in 3 minutes from the time he got out of the Jeep. So he was charged with murder, which was right charge. Mm-hmm. And I didn't expect him to convict him of murder. I thought maybe they'd convict him of manslaughter. Mm-hmm. And then when I was really angry when I found out he was a top MP on the base. Mm-hmm. So, and now they were going to have a trial. Mm-hmm. The trial up in November. So I went down. Me and my friend, lawyer friend of mine, went with me. And 4 day trial, 4.5 day trial. Mm-hmm. So on the fourth day, on the fifth day, rather, which is on a Friday, this judge, which was not, as far as I'm concerned, wasn't a judge, it was just somebody sitting up there. Mm-hmm. Said, well, the defense is closed, and we're going to give it to the jury. So I said, he said, well, it's 12 o'clock. We go to lunch, and then we come back. So we got up, we went out because we wanted to get lunch and get back, mm-hmm. you know. Before we could get to our cars, the jury, which was made up of 5 enlisted men and 1 sergeant major who had 35 years service, mm-hmm. they had said, we don't need no time. Don't you know they didn't find him guilty of nothing? Mm. He broke every rule, every regulation that the army had. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't find him guilty because if they had, the commander on the base, his commander would have been shot. Mm-hmm. So he had handpicked a jury so that they would not find him guilty. So in order to hang somebody, he went out to Mike's duty officer. Mm-hmm. And his commander, Mike's commanding officer. And he broke those two, killed mm-hmm. their career. I'm going to tell you something, and it's true. Mm-hmm. When I went there, I had a .32 pistol in my back pocket. It's about that small. Mm-hmm. And I had made up my mind, if they didn't find him guilty, I was going to kill him in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. And I would have. But the Lord moved me out of there. You know, I know, you know, if he hadn't, if we had stayed there for the verdict, I planned to shoot him. Well, no doubt in my mind, I was going to kill him. Mm-hmm. I was hurting, honey, I was hurting. Lord, God knows I was hurting. And when I got back, I was so depressed, I couldn't find nobody. We got back, the place was closed. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was dark, with a light on in the place. Mm-hmm. And I finally found a lieutenant. He said, Reverend Tansville, I've been my son out of Keeler at SOB. And I said, well, I would have if I'd been there. Mm-hmm. And the guy that went with me, he tried to give me all the support he could. He kept saying, I don't know how you can take it. And I came back home. I tell you, I was in deep depression. Mm-hmm. I didn't think I was going to ever preach again, tell you the truth. I was just so out of it. Mm-hmm. All I could think about was trying to find him that I could kill him. And you know, I had to wrestle with that for about a year mm-hmm. before I could really forgive him like I'm supposed to, like a Christian's supposed to. But we're human.
Yeah.
We're human. I had to deal with that, and Yvonne had to deal with it. But somehow we made it through. I think one of the things that really helped us, my oldest son's wife was pregnant. Sheila was pregnant with her first child. Mm-hmm. 7 months later, my grandson was born. And me and Yvonne drove down to Camp Lejeune with her mother. And Terry went over and picked the baby up and brought him over and put him in his mother's arms. And when I saw that look on her face, when the healing started. Because they had an apartment. We'd gotten her apartment right across the street. He had to go to Okinawa for a year. Mm-hmm. So when they moved from Lejeune, we found an apartment over here. And every day I would get him. Mm-hmm. Me and Yvonne, we took him, really, for the first 5 years of his life. And he was our bomb. He was our bomb, I tell you the truth. You know, the Lord taketh away, but the Lord also giveth. Mm-hmm. When he gave us, we called him Troy. When Carl III came on board, and he and I were just like that.
Grandpa's boy, huh?
he would be with me. If I was at a meeting, he would be there. When I had somebody come here to interview me on television, he'd just sit there, he wouldn't move. Mm-hmm. He was with me. And he always called me Carl, never called me nothing else but Carl.
Really?
Both of my grandsons, that's all they ever called me. Your mom would say, "That's your granddaddy. That's Carl." That's the first name they could say. And your mom said, they think you're a little playmate.
Now, how old are they now?
My oldest grandson is 29. Mm-hmm. My youngest one is 24. He'll be 24 in June.
Still call you Carl?
Still call me Carl. Now, my great-grandson, uh-huh. Devontae, which is DeAnthony's son, he calls me Papa. See, I tried to get the rest of them to call me Papa, but they wouldn't.
Wouldn't do it.
Tried to pay them.
Well, and now let me kind of back up just a little bit.
My involvement in the community, we need to talk about that.
Well, involvement in the community, absolutely. And specifically, kind of backing up a little bit, with Gainesboro, because you lived there for a while.
Well, I worked in Gainesboro the whole time. That was our community, really. We didn't, people were just, I was the third person moved in this neighborhood, mm-hmm. on this street, Lakeview and Spring Hill. And the lower Northwest Roanoke was where, we hung out, mm-hmm. YMCA on. But I got involved in scouting. Mm-hmm. When I was working two jobs, one that used to be a life insurance company right down Gainesboro, right beside Clayton's Clinic.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And upstairs. So he talked to me one day. He says, "You ought to get involved in scouting," because my brother-in-law, he was involved. He worked over at the Housing Authority. I mean, at the Lincoln Terrace, they just built that. And I'd help him some. So he said, "You need to get involved." I said, "I don't have time." So he said, "Ted, let me tell you. All these people around here, none of them have time. I don't have time. But we visit." So I got involved in scouting. And when I joined Pilgrim Baptist Church, I got a scout troop together. Mm-hmm. And worked in scouting for about 12 years. Also worked in sandlot football, baseball. Because when we moved up in this area, I wanted my kids to get involved. Mm-hmm. And so I had to get involved to get them involved.
Yeah.
I was serving on board at Southwest Community Development Fund. It just started when the urban renewal started. This is when they first started turning out everything.
Yeah, okay.
And I served on Southwest Board. Tom Morris was our first director. And Stan Hale, he's the director now, still there. We've done a lot. It was three agencies, BIE, CIE, and COED. We were COED in this community. Mm-hmm. And our job was to try to rebuild jobs, business, this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, they turned out all these houses. Mm-hmm. And What really upset me was the fact they tore out the best houses first.
Really?
I mean, houses that would still be standing be martyred. Because the people wanted, they got to murder, okay, we're going to take this property, we're going to tear all this out, and we're going to rebuild, and you can move back if you want to. Mm-hmm. That was the story they told. Mm-hmm. Well, the people who had the best houses and best connection, they sold, they made housing and started to take their house first. And so when the program changed after Johnson, then the program changed when Nixon, I think, was. So it took a turn, so they quit. And we had a lot of people out there still living in shacks. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, a lot of them still had outhouses out on the other end of where the Coca-Cola plant is now. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to sell some real estate, and a lot of people wanted to buy it. Well, they're going to take my house. I said, no, you better wait till you get the money, you know, before you really make it. Because you don't have enough money unless the house or do take your house. Mm-hmm. Well, it was 7 years later that they took this guy's house. He wanted to buy a house. He wouldn't have bought one, but I wouldn't sell this one. Because mm-hmm. I know that, you know, the housing authority was changing. They were doing different things. And I didn't think they meant, in fact, they didn't even, they had no, it was not their idea really to rebuild back in the community. Mm-hmm. That was going to make all that business cross from Gainesville Road all the way over, mm-hmm. up to Fifth Street. That was a city plan. Mm-hmm. But we got behind them and started pushing that they start building. And they start building over right off of Madison Avenue, back in that area. Mm-hmm. Now, I got involved in Gainesville Neighborhood Development Corporation. Percy Keaton was our president, and George Heller was the director. Mm-hmm. George, you need to talk to George Heller. He got a lot of history. Okay. And so we started rehabbing houses. We got money from the city block rent fund, and we were doing a great job, really. But during that time, it was also drugs. There was a lot of drugs on there. Mm-hmm. Well, Hooper was a police chief. They didn't care if the drugs stayed in the black community. Fairfax used to be an open drive. People would drive through there, stop to come, you know. Mm-hmm. And we had rehabbed two houses up there. We went in there thinking it was going to cost us $20,000, and we wound up spending about $60,000. Mm. So we had to tear it all the way down to the frame. And we couldn't sell them. Nobody would buy. Mm-hmm. Nobody wanted to buy up there where you have people, you know, drugs rampaging during that time. And so the housing authority took those houses. And when Percy got sick, I became president. And over on Madison Avenue, those townhouses, mm-hmm. that was a project we wanted to do, and I wanted to see it through. Well, we started that project. I got a commitment from the bank for the money, and then the bank went under. Which one was that? Sovereign.
Okay.
Remember when Sovereign went under? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I had to go to another bank, and I went to Nation Bank. They agreed to let me have the money, but to piecemeal it. Mm-hmm. So it took a good while to build that, and it cost us probably $800,000 more. And I finally sold the last house in 90, what was it? In the 90s when I sold the last uh-huh. house. But it was a beautiful community. And that's the one thing that I'm proud of. Mm-hmm. We built those townhouses. And I almost did it single-handed because I had Margaret Turpin was our director. Mm-hmm. And I had several people serve on the board, but they were afraid. They were older people. They didn't want to get sued. I can understand. And they finally started dropping off. And really, me and Margaret was running the whole game. Mm-hmm. And I kept people advised, and I got to meet a lot of people, and I learned a lot about that. Mm-hmm. But when we finished it, I told them, I said, well, I want the community to get involved. People that bought those houses, you should be involved now in what else goes on over here. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, we had rehabbed about 60, close to 70-some houses up through that area. Mm-hmm. And I feel we did a wonderful job. But the housing authority sat on a lot of that land when it could have, should have been, and money provided to the block grant to redevelop it like it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
But now the city have different plans. We just found out lately, we found out years ago, rather, that the city had plans that didn't include that. They had what they call that 20-year plan all the way up to 5th Street. And it didn't include in the, in fact, their plan was to get rid of all the property between that and 5th Street. Mm. So I started working with another group with Miss Davis and her sister, Betha, and when First Baptist Church got built, mm-hmm. we were working trying to make sure that we maintain that area, and certainly that the church was taken care of. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the promises was made. We, Percy, when we were with Gainesville Development, Percy Killen and the Reverend Wright was involved at that time. We had to do a study. The city gave us $105,000 mm-hmm. to do a feasibility study about Henry Street to come up with a plan for it. Mm-hmm. We got a group out of Atlanta, Georgia to come here and to do a study and to make plans. Mm-hmm. And we presented the plans to the city. And they set it aside. Because they didn't mean for it to be developed like we wanted it. Mm-hmm. It was business and restaurants. It was going to be restored, really. Mm-hmm. Pretty much like it was.
Okay.
But they didn't mean for that to happen. So they put it on the side and they said, at that time Taylor become mayor, we're going to give this to Mayor Taylor. That's going to be his project. Well, that killed it right there. Because there was nothing ever done. And now we're still fighting about the Social Security building mm-hmm. and the higher education building. I don't think that bothers as much as taking the other land using. Mm-hmm. We wanted to maintain some identity mm-hmm. to Henry Street rather than just say, you got a bridge that represents Henry Street or the Dumas Hotel. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of changes. And you know what? It would have been nice if it would have been all for the good. It was all for the work, sometimes for selfish reasons.
Mm-hmm. Well, you just mentioned the Dumas?
The Dumas Hotel.
Do you remember any entertainers who came to Dumas?
Oh, God, yes. Well, we used to have, before they tore down, did the Vada, mm-hmm. The old auditorium down on Wells Avenue. That's where they used to have all the dances. Mm-hmm. James Brown, Count Basie, Hideo, what's his name? all the big bands. Right. Well, the only place they could stay was at the Dumas. Uh-huh. That was a classic place. You know, the only place blacks had to stay. And of course, going to the dance down there on Wells Avenue, it was always when I walked in there, because when I come to service, I hitchhiked from Norfolk. We had bust up some planes, mm-hmm. and I was in Norfolk. So I get up here to go to one of dances. And we danced. We never won no concert. We danced.
Yeah.
Lord, we was in that dance. Our folks was dressed up and they looked like a flower garden. All the white folks was up in the balcony. And they had police that were trying to keep them from coming down, so they'd come down and get mixed up. You couldn't stay still with that music. It was beautiful. And then Joe Mansour built a place up on Wells Avenue. Mm-hmm. And that's when it started happening. But all of the performers coming here, the only place they had to stay was the Dumas. Mm-hmm. Count Basie. And I got to see a lot of them. Silas Green's show used to come here. That was something else. That, it was wonderful. They used to have it at the Virginia Theater and sometime out in tents. But that was beautiful.
Now, did you see James Brown?
Oh, God, yes.
Did you?
Let me tell you, as far as I'm concerned, James Brown are the same age. Mm-hmm. He had the best band of any singing group in the land. Mm-hmm. When you walked in, the James Brown's band was going, your feet would automatically start just...
Couldn't stay still.
Couldn't stay still. I mean, those feet would start moving. Yeah, when he first started out, first time I think he came to Rhode, I was here. James Brown. I mean, he was a showman. And I agree, he was the hardest working man in show business. Mm. He put on a show that wouldn't wait. Yes, indeed. And Lionel Hampton, it was good to see him beat them. those guys were young, B.B. King and Fats Domino. Mm-hmm. See, all those guys that used to come through here.
Well, I had no idea.
Oh, yes. Roanoke was a famous place for entertainment, you know, for especially on our side. Mm-hmm. And Fats Domino, I remember we went to see Fats once. He had his feet up, and there was a hole in the bottom of his shoe. That's the entertainment part, yes. My wife and I, we used to, when I was dating her, I took her to some of the events down on Wells Avenue.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said your community service or your community work?
Well, I've been involved in NAACP, mm-hmm. Southwest Community Development Fund, mm-hmm. COID, which is our oldest community organization. How many others? A couple of others I can't remember now. Mm-hmm. But in the Y, I always supported the YMCA. I was hoping, and it had been my dream and Percy's dream and a lot of people's dream here in Roanoke, that we were going to build a Y for the black people. Mm-hmm. We had the land, and we had a lot of money. Just never got off the ground. When Taylor started, they started talking about putting the Ys together, you know. Mm-hmm. So they took our money and our land, and we got nothing from it. And that thing broke Percy's heart. So Percy Killen was one of the most outstanding guys in the community because he ran the Y. Mm-hmm. The old Y used to be the big building right on Gainsborough upstairs. I got a picture of me hanging out the window doing an interview with one of the guys from Roanoke Times. Mm-hmm. But those are the organizations, Southwest, COID, NAACP, SCLC, you know, all of the civil rights organizations. Mm-hmm. Plus, I was a Masonic Mason, mm-hmm. and trying to preach in pastor churches and work. Mm. I had a handful.
Busy guy.
Yes, Lord. Well, I had more energy then. I don't have that energy today, I'll tell you.
Well, I guess now we'll close the interview, but is there anything that we didn't cover that you'd like to share that you can think of?
When I first came to Roanoke and I just got married, I served on the biracial committee, mm-hmm. when they started integrating the schools. And one of the things white people from across the community, and I can't remember everybody's name now, myself, Taylor, Avon Smith, and Dr. Law, a few others who served on those committees. Mm-hmm. We met downtown at the cafeteria then, I believe it was S&W. And, you know, worked on a plan to try to keep things at a stable place. Mm-hmm. In 1965, I got a call from, I actually got a brewer called me, my guy I worked with. Mm-hmm. Kiwanis Club wanted some black to speak with him about this immigration. So he wouldn't do it. He asked me if I would do it. I said, yeah, I'll do it. So anyhow, they invited me out to the Oasis, which was a segregated restaurant at that time. Mm-hmm. And we went in the back room. It was about 45 white gentlemen. And they fed me steak and potatoes and, you know, tea. So after I eat, got up, and they were eating to hear what I had to say. I got up and I looked at them. I said, okay, I want y'all to turn black. They looked at me funny. I said, I want you to turn black. Because you're not going to know what I'm talking about unless you walk in my shoes. Mm-hmm. I want you to look from my point of view. And I know why you're upset. I said, I know why what's upsetting you now. You don't want the schools on the red because your forefathers and your grandfathers have taken advantage of our women down through the years. I said, look at me. I should be black, nappy hair, maybe big lips, African descent. I'm not. I could be one of y'all's brothers. You know, who knows? Mm-hmm. I said, but you're afraid that your little white daughters and the little black boys are going to get together. I got news for you. What goes around comes around. That's going to happen.
How did they take to your speech?
You know what? You could hear a pin fall for 45 minutes. Mm. But I just laid it out on the line. I said, now, if you hadn't lied to your children, And many of them have found out that you lied, and they look down on you for that, because you told them that black people were inferior, they were lazy, they were this and that. And I said, now they found out going to school with them, that's not so. They're human just like they are. And you can't stop people from getting together when they start liking each other. So I said, they're going to be all right. It's us I'm worried about. Because we were not exposed to this. We didn't expect this, but it's coming. So we have to make sure that we can work together to make sure that everybody have an equal opportunity. So we can't stop what's going on now. It's going to happen. Well, they must enjoy it because they got the women, and I had to speak to the women group. Now, they didn't appreciate it, I don't think, as much as the men.
I was going to say, did you tone it down for the women at all?
I did tone it down. I really did. I didn't speak to them on the same level I did the men.
Yeah.
Because you know how mamas are about the daughters.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess we're going to close for now. And
yeah, if we could put everything in that tape that I've been through and been involved in this community, you'd have to have about a dozen, maybe 100 tapes.
Well, we got an overview.
Yeah, this is just an overview of what my life has been like. But I have been a staunch person for justice. I really have. During the time when Hooper was president, was chief of police, a lot of things happened under his watch that was wrong. It was totally wrong. And one incident happened when the Kroger's used to be over here on 19th Street. There was a black man stole a bottle of wine. He was running. The policeman, off-duty policeman, shot him in the back. And they won't do anything about it. So I had the Justice Department come in here and work with the police department. And they wind up firing the guy because he really had no business doing what he did. But Chief Hooper hated me with all his power. I feel sorry for him, really. Because he wanted to run a police department like he run the Nazis was running, Gestapo. Take no prisoners. When you shoot to kill. Nobody can talk. And a lot of policemen told me, and not all policemen are bad. I want to make that plain. You have some good policemen on that force, but you can't be a good police and be there with a couple of bad apples in the bucket. Because, there's a code. You don't talk about each other's profession, especially people that's working with you. But a lot of them off the record told me that, he was something else. They couldn't even talk to him. They couldn't get to him. And he needed to go. So he finally, he had cancer and died. I wanted once to go to his funeral. I said, no, he might get up.
We wouldn't want that.
And, I've cultivated some good relations here in town. Now, one of my greatest achievements, I think, is the fact that I was a Jesse Jackson delegate in 1984 and 1988. When Jesse decided to run for president, I've been serving, I didn't tell you my political part. I served on the Democrat party, and I served as chairman during the year that Doug was elected. But I was vice chairman for a number of years. Chip Woodrum, Vic Thomas, and all of us, all of us were Democrats together working. So at that time, I was having a mass meeting. And whoever had the most people out for the candidate, we get the delegates. So Chip had asked me, he says, Carl, how many do you think you can get out? I said, Chip, you know how my folk are. If I get 10, I'll be lucky. I got on the phone. I had people get on the phone. I was calling people everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
That Saturday, about 125 showed up.
Oh, wow.
We took the majority of the delegates. And, of course, I went to Richmond to the state convention and was elected as a delegate to the, well, from here to the national. Myself, John Edwards, and I don't know what Chip went on now. But anyhow, it was quite an experience. Oh my God, was it an experience.
And what year was that?
1984. Good year.
Well, you certainly
I was there when he made that speech at Friday. I'm going to tell you, honey, if I never go to another, see another one, there should never be another one like that. I've never seen such jubilant. It was almost like it was a church service. Hmm. When he got up and spoke, he had a text. And I got a copy over here somewhere now. And then after a while, he just moved to the side. And it was, I was in the back lane. It looked like a shadow. Moved across stage and just got in here.
Hmm.
And I mean, when he got through, everybody was jumping up and down. People were crying, white and black. I mean, we were, you wouldn't believe the jubilant that was there. It was something else. If they had an election that night, he'd get elected.
Well, I think that one thing is for certain, you have had a very industrious life and definitely worked for what you believed. I think that definitely comes through.
In 1988, I got a chance to go to Atlanta when they had the convention there. And that was another place that, nothing like it. If you ever have a chance to go to a national Democrat, I don't know how the Republican convention, but I know how Democrats are.
We'll just guess about the Republican.
Yeah. it's really something to behold. The people you meet. And you know, when I went to California, it was in San Francisco in 84.
Mm-hmm.
I got off the plane with my wife. I never been to California before, didn't know nobody. Somebody says, Carl! He was a guy, Joe Calloway, I believe his name is.
Mm-hmm.
He used to live up here in Rona, but he'd been out there for several years.
Oh, wow.
So he picked me and my wife up, and we showed us around, and the next day we had time. And I got a chance to meet Willie Brown.
Mm-hmm.
He was the state chair. What was his position? He was in charge of the Senate in the State House.
Mm-hmm.
They had a party out there. It was three blocks long.
Mm.
And the people was, it was so many people there. It was just like a sea of people. You were moving like this.
Mm-hmm.
And they had kind of food and music from every nationality. It was on the docks. And it was, I mean, you just walk from one place to the other. Food all kinds. We first got there, we didn't buy enough food for the first 3 days. Because everywhere we went, they had these knickknacks, and you know, you eat all the time, you're eating all the time, so you weren't hungry.
Mm-hmm.
So on Wednesday, I told my wife, I said, listen, I want some steak and eggs. That's when I found out San Francisco was cold.
Oh.
We got out there that day, it was hot. God, it was hot. They were having a heat wave, really.
Mm-hmm.
Man said, we ain't had this kind of weather in I don't know when. And we check in this hotel, no air conditioning. I'm raising hell. Me, they had no air conditioning.
Is it hot?
Yeah. Hey, but that night, oh God, they had a chef in the bathroom. You could open the door. Had air coming out through there that night. We like froze.
Really?
I mean, that room got cold.
Mm-hmm.
Next morning, I'm looking out the window downstairs. People got on fur coats and leather jackets. And this is in July, whenever the National Convention was, summer months. And the lady had told me before I left here, she said, Reverend, care winter clothes, don't care no summer clothes. You won't need them. And we went across the bridge, Golden Gate Bridge. Joe took us across and we went up in the mountain. It was raining. We come out of the rain, through the clouds. Went on up on the mountain, the sun shining beautiful as you ever seen.
Oh.
That's quite a treat. You driving out here, and all at once, you go through the clouds. Rain stopped, sun shining.
You don't like the weather, just drive up the mountain.
Drive up to the mountain.
Okay, well, I'm going to stop this for now, and thank you very much.